Thank you. All right, so this is joint work with David Spivak.
And before I really start, let me make two caveats.
So the first one is that this is more of really an outline of a research program more than something presenting actual results. So this is very preliminary, and I can't actually say all that much about QFT. We'll only try to give a sort of preliminary definition. And also, this was not actually intended originally when I had started this to be about QFT, but more about just a theory of stochastic processes, actually. But then I realized when thinking about what to speak here at this conference, well, I mean, a stochastic process, we're not really using the fact that time is one-dimensional for stochastic processes. The same stuff applies for any number of time dimensions. And so then if we do that, then what we have is a statistical field theory, or in other words, Euclidean quantum field theory. yeah, so I don't really know all that much about QFT. And then another thing that I'm obviously aware of is that there's nothing really quantum, going to be anything quantum in this talk. So this is really not the typical quantum foundations conference talk. So if you feel bored at some point, or just whatever, this is not your cup of tea, please feel free to leave and do something else. I mean, I certainly don't mind. Okay, so yeah, given this, let me start by saying what I mean by synthetic. So synthetic is to be understood in contrast to analytic. And so whenever you have some kind of theory of something, some mathematical formalism, one way to classify at what kind of formalism it is on the spectrum of synthetic versus analytic. So if you look, for example, at a mathematical formalisms for Euclidean geometry, the original one was Euclid's axioms. These are very synthetic, so they are kind of just formulated in terms of pure logic, and they're not very concrete. They don't tell you what a point is or what a line is. While now, if we go further in history and to Descartes, then he introduced coordinates and analytic geometry. I think that's also probably where the name comes from. There, points and lines are now really kind of have structure themselves and are much more concrete objects defined in terms of more fundamental things like the real numbers. And so this is an analytic approach to Euclidean geometry. And so the idea is that the stuff that is more synthetic is kind of more formal. And in this way, because of this, it's easier to work with generally, because you have less structure. And so you can do fewer things. While on the analytic side, these things are typically more concrete, more precise, as in more specific. So they allow you to do more, but you might have to work a little bit harder. So it's a bit rough, and it's not always completely clear where to fit in a particular framework, formalism. But for quantum mechanics, I would roughly say that wave functions are a very analytic concept. Right, it's very concrete. It's based on talking about space. They necessarily live in space. And a little bit more abstract and analytic, we have the Hilbert space and operators formalism. And then maybe even going a little bit further and even abstracting away from that, we get C-star algebras. Maybe GTPs are also kind of synthetic in a way. although, of course, quite going in a different direction with C-star algebras. But yeah, so just roughly to say what I mean by synthetic versus analytic. And so now let's get to Euclidean QFT. on the analytic side, we have things like the Gibbs measures, where we look at, for example, spin systems, spin lattices. And then the Gibbs measures and phase transitions are described by let's call the DLR equations. Maybe I'll still get to this at the end, but probably I won't have time. And maybe a little bit more synthetic are these relatively recent developments in terms of regularity structures. So this is a formalism to make precise mathematical sense of quantum field theories, including renormalization and all that. So first, the Fields Medal was awarded in 2014. These seem really exciting developments, which unfortunately I don't really know anything about. But yeah, is there something here? Can we go even more synthetic than that? And so that's what I want to present an approach going this direction. And so to give an idea of how this, what this looks like, let's see what, so Euclidean, a quantum field theory lives on space-time, and space-time has a certain number of dimensions. So if this number of dimensions d, generally when we do, it's always nice and helpful to start with the simplest cases. So what is Euclidean quantum field theory in the lowest dimension? Well, the lowest dimension is d equals zero. So when we have just this, so then we just have a single point of space, or space-time, and in this case, the Euclidean QFT, well, that's a probability space. D equals one. So now we just have one dimension of space, or if we think about it as time, then what we have is stochastic theory of stochastic processes. Okay, and so yeah, in general, higher dimensions, well, then we have generic, let's say the things that one would consider as actual Euclidean QFTs are not in some sense degenerate. Okay, and so what I want to do is to try and outline how one can understand these two as special cases of the first. So it's a sort of reduction of general Euclidean QFT in arbitrary dimension to the concept of probability space. So I want to present a definition that looks like just the definition of probability space, but in a form within a mathematical background theory, within a certain kind of logic that is weaker than the usual classical logic. And where the structure of space in which the theory lives is built in. So the structure of space does not come into the definition of the QFT, but into the logic that one uses to reason mathematically. And this is a standard, I mean, a couple of decades old kind of logic called basically intuitionistic logic, or also more or less equivalently topos theory. And I want to say a little about what that is, but let's start with the d equals zero case. Probability theory. And because this whole approach is kind of based on a certain kind of logic, I also need to and want to formulate probability theory via logic. And massage it a little so that it takes a form that is amenable to this reduction that makes it look like it's based on some kind of logical thing. Okay, so the basic observation is that, well, what do we do in probability theory? Well, we want to make statements, assign real numbers, probabilities or likelihoods or whatever you want to call them, to logical propositions. So probability theory assigns numbers to logical propositions. So a logical proposition would be, for example, it is raining. So what is the probability that it's raining, let's say, tomorrow? Okay, so then we should be able to talk about the probability of this this logical proposition being true, I intentionally don't want to say event, which looks more like Kolmogorov's axioms in the standard approach, to emphasize that it's really about logical statements.
You want to say will, Ray?
Pardon me?
Say is. Now?
It doesn't matter. Yeah, let's say tomorrow. It will be, okay.
Oh, why not?
It will rain tomorrow.
Huh? If you're outside, it seems to me it's raining.
Yeah, so then that will be 0 or 1. But it's just an example. I mean, yeah. Okay. It will rain tomorrow. Well. Sorry. I don't have much space here. Okay. So now, how do we capture this mathematically in terms of some precise definition? And for that, I need to say what sort of mathematical structure the set of all logical propositions carries. And so what turns out to be most convenient for the upcoming generalization is that a collection of logical propositions that we want to reason with or make statements about is supposed to be what's called a frame. So a frame is a partially ordered set and so the frame at point is denoted by F, and so it comes equipped with a partial order, which also is a complete lattice. So let me take a step back and explain what this means. So we have the set of logical propositions here, and a partial order is supposed to encode an implication. So one statement is below another, if and only if the first one implies the second. And so correspondingly, later on, we're going to have that probabilities are monotone under that. So when one statement implies the second, then the first one should have probability is less than or equal to the probability of the second. And lattice means that with respect to this partial order, we have, joins and meets, which means that we can form logical and logical or of these propositions.
This is on top of the usual probability space.
Pardon me?
No, this is on top of the usual probability.
No, there is no, I don't want to use probability spaces in the usual sense.
So how do you define probability?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
So far, it's just a structure of logical propositions. There's not going to be any sort of underlying space of outcomes or omega or whatever.
Measure space.
Exactly. No, there is nothing like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
X is above Y if X implies Y or Y implies X.
This would mean that X implies Y.
Okay.
Implications sort of takes us higher up, more towards truth.
So implication length matters.
Sorry?
Implication length matters.
Length?
Yeah, you just said that. The more implications, the more truth.
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah. So false implies everything, implies anything, right? So false is at the bottom.
I see.
Okay. And then... Oh, and there's one additional condition, which I can also explain or motivate in a second, for all X and F and arbitrary families of propositions YI, that if I take X and the disjunction of all the YIs, so OR of all of these, then that should be equal to taking the OR of all of X and YI. So roughly this is saying that, imagine that I ask you, do you want to have a cookie and coffee or tea? Well, then that's the same. So cookie, coffee or tea, you have a two-element family, that's the same as saying, do you want a cookie and tea, or a cookie and coffee? And in this case, there can even be infinitely many flavors of coffee and tea, which is kind of, yeah, contemporary. Yeah.
Do you mean to say the family has to be countable?
No. But this are really, yeah, that's an important technical point. This is really intended to be arbitrary families. I'll get to corresponding. So a more technical mathematical example is if x comma O of x is a topological space, so this means that x is a set and O of x is, well, it's a collection of open sets, then, well, these open sets are ordered under inclusion, and then this forms the frame. Okay, so this, the fact that when we have this property has to do with that, well, open sets are closed under infinite arbitrary unions, but only under finite intersections. So that's why this one holds, but the other one where we interchange the and or would not necessarily hold. And the reason that open sets are kind of important in topology and also in this framework is because open sets are precisely those in which it is easy to witness membership. If you have a point, well, how do you witness membership? You need to find a neighborhood that is still contained in the open set. So this is why open sets are important. So we should think of these logical propositions also as playing the role of it's easy to witness that they're true, but not necessarily that they're false. There are also other frames that are not like this, but they're actually not so easy to construct. So this is really the main example, and these are the frames that that I'm kind of thinking about. Okay, and so now assigning probabilities to these logical propositions, what does that look like? Probabilities. So now I'm coming to a definition that, as far as I know, originally comes from computer science. Actually, maybe not, but at least computer scientists have studied mostly in recent decades. And this is now the analog of a probability measure in this approach. And so it's called continuous probability evaluation. And so this is a map, mu. What we want to do is to assign to every logical proposition, meaning to every element of F, a non-negative number, which corresponds to its probability, such that a bunch of axioms are satisfied. Well, the probability of false should be zero. Well, false, and so false in this kind of context is typically denoted by bottom. This is so this is zero, and correspondingly, well, the true proposition denoted like this, kind of like a T and pronounced top, so nicely opposite to bottom, should be one. So this should be obvious, and if x implies y, then, as I've already said, the probability of x should be less than or equal to the probability of y. The third equation is the inclusion-exclusion relation. If we take the probability that two propositions both hold, plus the probability that at least one of them holds, then that's equal to the sum of the two probabilities. So I hope that this makes sense. This comes from a simple sort of Venn diagram. I mean, someone can motivate this, right? This just additivity of probabilities, in a way, encoded now in this in terms of the frame. So here, what we're doing on both sides is to count the probability of this event once, of this event once, and of this event twice. That's, yes, right. I've been a bit sloppy here. This is part of the completeness requirement here for the lattice. The join of the empty set or image of the empty set. Okay. And the final one, this is the continuity requirement for any. I don't think I want to spend too much time explaining this. For any directed family, Xi, so again, this does not have to be countable, but some family that is sort of increasing, the probability that at least one of them is true should exactly be the supremum of the probability that, well, for each individual one. Okay, and yeah, this maybe this answers why I don't want any sort of countability, because this axiom really applies to all families. Okay, but now in order for this to be meaningful, we better have some statement about how this relates to the usual standard probability theory based on Kolmogorov's axioms. And there is quite a number of results about this. So let me just briefly write down one of them, which seems kind of the most relevant to me. So this is due to Alvarez, Mania, 02. These are statements about this case. When we start with a topological space, and the frame of logical propositions that we look at is the set of opens. And so there's some condition on the space, we call this regular, sort of like some separation that at points can be distinguished in some way. Then the continuous probability valuations on its frame of opens are in bisection with basically probability measures on X in the usual sense, but now modulo some technical niceness conditions saying that, yeah, namely, for those of you who know what this means, regular and tau smooth Borel probability measures on X. Okay, but for my purposes, that definition is really, in some sense, the better one. And also, maybe as a small aside, let me say that maybe you know the Bonoff-Tarski paradox, which basically, some kind of seemingly paradoxical statement, has to do with the fact that in standard probability theory, measure theory, not all sets of our Euclidean space or N can be measurable, if you want to have a well-behaved measure. And this is also kind of resolved in a different way by this. So in this framework, one can have the measurability and the concept of Euclidean measure, the back measure on Euclidean space, in a way that where all sets are measurable, but the Bonoff-Tarski paradox still does not come up. It has to do with the fact that disjoint sets are not necessarily disjoint in this, but if they have common boundary, then there's some glue between them. I'm drifting off. Okay, so this is what I want to call probability space. Continuous probability evaluation, this is equal to probability space. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about the d equals zero case. And now I want to get to the general. Yeah?
Am I right in thinking that this is basically creating a measure space out of point free topology?
Exactly. This frame stuff, as you said, is called point free topology or pointless topology also.
Same thing. Yeah, okay.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so now let me switch gears and forget about probabilities again for a second, because now I want to introduce this logic that I want to use in order to achieve that reduction. And so that logic is, it goes under the name of topos theory, and it's basically the logic of space. And so for now, let me try to give a very rough introduction to topos theory. And for that, let's go back to my example, a logical proposition from over there. Namely, it is raining. So now I really want to have it is raining. And ask what are the possible truth values of this statement. Well, if you want to answer it, you might say, I think it's not raining. So, but then you're making a certain assumption, namely that I'm asking, is it raining right now and right here? But in general, the answer, depends on where you are and about what time you're asking the question, right? So the answer is actually a function of space and time. So that means if we want to assess the truth of this statement, it's not just a Boolean true or false, but the truth value now really is a function. A function. So the truth value is a function. And so let me denote space-time by S from now on, and then the following to the usual Boolean truth values. Or equivalently, I can say that the truth value I can identify such a function with the set of all points at which it's true, right? Then I know that on all the other points it's false. That means I can identify this truth value with the collection of points at which it is raining.
Bit to put question for which there is no kind of definite answer.
Uh-huh.
We'll use only it is raining in X.
Yeah.
Can we do all things without this machinery? or it will fail?
Well, that's a standard approach, let's say. For my purposes, you're saying, well, we just have the usual Boolean truth values. But then if you do that, you have to treat space explicitly. And so then you cannot do all the things that I'm going to do. And this is just to motivate that there can be more truth values than just the usual Boolean ones. Motivating example for doing that. And the actual purpose, but the actual purpose is to achieve that reduction. Okay. So now, as I was saying, I want to think about these propositions as the ones that are for which the truth is easy to witness as true. So that means the set of truth values I want to identify with the open sets in space-time. So not arbitrary sets here, but only the open ones. And so this is, think of it like this, if it's raining here, so this is space-time, and it's raining in this interval, well then at this boundary point, is it raining or not? We're kind of not sure. Right? So that's why I only want to take those places where it's really definitely clear, and those places form this open interval. So the set of truth values is the frame of opens. And again, here we have a frame. Truth values are logical propositions. So hence, this is all consistent. So the frame of opens, O of S. If those of you have heard of kind of modal logic before, this is very similar and kind of a generalization of modal logic. And that's so the points of space-time now we can also think of as possible worlds where a particular proposition can be true or false. Okay. So now this results in a kind of propositional logic for of space. So this gives propositional logic of space. We take so and yeah, within that there's an additional subtlety or thing on top now that we can also define another kind of implication. I was saying implication is the inclusion, but we can also define a new kind of implication, which is itself an open set and therefore a truth value, and to be interpreted as the set of all points at which this open set is contained in this open set. So, yeah, maybe I shouldn't spend too much time on this, but one can it's basically defined as the union or the disjunction of all the W's for which W intersection U is contained in V. and let me just give one quick example. In the case S equals R, so this real line, if we consider the interval 0 to 2 as a potential truth value, also the interval of the open interval from 1 to 3 is a truth value, and the implication between these is again a truth value, and it turns out to be the open set from minus infinity to 0, because at all these points neither of these is true, So the implication is correct. Union 1 to infinity. As soon as I'm above 1, then this antecedent, well, then the consequent is true. So it doesn't matter what the antecedent is. So then this also works. And on all the other points, the consequent is true. But the antecedent is true, but the consequent is false. So we don't take the points between 0 and 1. And while the boundary points we have to exclude because we want an open set. OK, so this is roughly how this works. So as a special case, we also get negation. Negation is just well defined as the truth value u implies false, bottom, or now in this topological case, empty set. and this is in terms of the opens, what we have. So this is again an open set, which corresponds to the interior of the complement. So basically, it's a complement of u, but it has to be open again. So we take the interior of that complement, and we can illustrate this here as well. What is the truth value of the proposition that is not raining? Well, it's the complement of this set. But again, we have to exclude the boundary points. But because of the boundary points, again, we're not sure. Here, it's definitely not raining. And so this leads to the fact that not it is raining would correspond to this half open interval union this half open interval. OK. And one thing that one can see from this is that this logic is quite a bit weaker than what we're the usual classical logic that we reason with, namely in that u or not u does not need to be true. So the law of excluded middle fails. And this is already, so this is exactly what's happening here. We take the u to be this proposition, it's raining, the truth value is this open set. Then for the complement, for the negation, we have this union this. So now the union of the two, which corresponds to the disjunction, is still missing these boundary points. So the disjunction is not equal to true, and so the law of excluded middle fails. This is one of the main sort of features or absent features of this logic. So this is not equal to, top. So law of excluded middle fails. similarly, the law of double negation fails, which means that not u does not necessarily equal to u. But otherwise, pretty much all the usual stuff works. And so in the end, one can still work with this. And so this is what makes it so nice. One can work with this more or less as if it was just conventional ordinary logic based on just true and false Boolean logic. If you're careful enough to avoid using the law of excluded middle.
So it's equivalent to intuitionistic?
It's intuitionistic logic. It's just that I wouldn't want to use too many scary terms. OK, so most other, I can be a bit more precise about this, but let me first write this down, are still valid. So for example, modus ponens is something that one can prove. So if we have now three, and this is three open sets, u, v, and w, then these two implications imply u implies w. You can also really interpret this as a statement about topological spaces. For any topological space in any three open sets, if you form this open set, it's going to be the whole space. Okay, so and generally speaking, the valid arguments, so the valid rules of inference that one is allowed to use are those that are constructive. So this means that, how was I going to explain this? Those that are built basically out of explicit steps, things that you could turn into a computer program. Okay. So much about propositional logic. But in order to do anything non-trivial, propositional logic isn't really enough, right? We also want quantifiers. And so this is perfectly possible. And so this is now basically Topos theory. So this is the above logic plus quantifiers. And again, one can reason with this. It's just how one is normally used to it, except that one has to be careful that all steps must be constructive. So you need to be able to implement them, basically write computer programs on in terms of completely explicit steps. And so the nice thing about this is that now we can work with mathematical objects in this logic that just look like individual objects from the inside, so from the interior of the logic. Also then if you translate them into what it means from the external perspective, then they look like objects that vary in space. So with these truth values, these are like Boolean truth values, but that vary in space. But we can, for many purposes, we can reason with these just as we reason with true and false ordinary truth values. So as long as we're careful enough to only use constructive reasoning. And the same applies to any other mathematical objects. So we can reason in terms of constructive logic about individual objects, but what these really secretly represent is families of objects over space that vary in space. Okay, so let me give an example of how this works. So from now on, I will work in this logic when I talk about the translation or the external semantics of these things. So within this logic, we can formulate still many of the usual definitions and prove many of the usual theorems that are part of mathematics. So for example, a topological space, well, basically I'm writing down the usual definition. It's a set X together with a subset. O of X, and now we have to be careful here what it is a subset of. Usually it's a subset of the power set, because the open sets are sets, meaning elements of the power set. But so the power set is based on exponentiating with respect to the Booleans, and so what we have to do here is exponentiate with respect to the truth values. So one has to be careful that there are these subtle differences. Okay. Yeah?
When you say exponentiate,
uh-huh.
You mean just all the functions from
Yes, yes, that's exactly what I mean. If basically write down the definition of function in this logic, and then, yeah.
So it's not all the classical functions, it's all
no.
Intuitionistic.
Yeah, yeah. So what it means from the externally is, well, then technically these objects are going to be sheaves on the space, and then this is the sheaf of natural transformations between them. Okay, and while these things should satisfy all the usual axioms, these still make sense. So the empty set and X itself should be elements of O of X, meaning that this is a proposition whose truth value should be top. And then likewise, no, should be closed under, well, binary intersections. Plus arbitrary unions. Okay, so then one can still reason about topological spaces. And so now there is, if you work out what this means from the external perspective, it turns out that these correspond, roughly speaking, at least to families of spaces parameterized by spacetime. Or, so in other words, kind of bundles over spacetime. Here we can maybe see right, how this is going in a bit of a QFT direction where one considers fields that are sections of bundles. Okay, so yeah, an individual object represents a family of objects indexed by space. Okay, time is short, so let me maybe say that there are, because the logic is weaker than the usual one, certain things are no longer provable. For example, you can construct the real numbers, and you can construct them in different ways, right? Usually there is a definition in terms of Cauchy sequences, there's a definition in terms of Dedekind cuts. In order to prove that these are equivalent, one needs to use the law of excluded middle. So in this case, they no longer are equivalent, and it turns out that there actually are several inequivalent notions of what a real number is. And that may seem kind of unpleasant, but it does turn out to be a feature because one does want to distinguish them. So the semantics of, for example, the Dedekind construction of the real numbers turns out to correspond to continuous functions on spacetime. So an individual real number from the inside of the logic looks externally like a continuous function. And so this is a bit like this reduction here, just not for probability spaces, but for functions. And if we use a slightly different construction of the real numbers called the lower reals, then we get what corresponds to lower semi-continuous functions. Doesn't matter too much what these are, but for technical reasons, these turn out to be the ones that I want to use. Okay, so now again, inside the topos, we can write down what a probability space is. Now we can do that. And I mean, I had previously written down the definition of continuous probability evaluation. And now, well, it's literally the same definition. I don't have to modify anything because this one already turns out to work nicely. On the space X is, yeah, so the same as before. Okay. So, yeah, so now the question is, now we got a definition of probability space internal to this logic. So what does it really correspond to from the outside? Well, as I said, everything corresponds to a family of mathematical objects indexed by points in spacetime. And so the same is true here. We haven't actually proven this in general yet, but so at least if S is a discrete space, then the internal probability spaces are in correspondence with families of probability spaces. XS of XS and mu S indexed by points in space time. So yeah, for Euclidean quantum field theory, is this what we want? This Euclidean QFT or stochastic process or whatever, you look like this. No, right? So this is just a bunch of random, basically a bunch of random variables indexed by S, but they only have individual distributions. They're not strongly distributed. We cannot talk about correlations here, precisely because everything is just varying with point in space time. So and we also cannot talk about non-local observables, which we also might want. For example, we'll talk about correlation functions. We compare the field values to two different points in space. So this is really not what we want. Okay, so let me wrap up by saying what we think works, and for which we have a partial proof. Basically, we need to modify the space that we're working with. We still need to modify the logic a little. It's taking space-time as our space that we use for the logic history not to work. So, and the reason in some sense is also that we want to make sense of other logical propositions that are of a non-local character. So, for example, we also want to be able to make sense of statements like the temperature varies by at most 2 degrees. So if you think of temperature as sort of like a field, then this is a non-local statement. In the same way as talking about correlation functions in a QFT is a non-local thing. I just want to present this example because it's kind of more intuitive. Okay, so this is the truth of this. It's no longer a function of a point in space-time, but it's a function of a region in space-time, right? So instead of assigning these Boolean truth values to points in space-time, we should be assigning Boolean truth values to regions in space-time. And this does turn out to work, at least to some extent. We haven't proven it completely yet, but this is the idea. So a region in space-time
is a compact subset. K in S, and these, so the collection of all regions together form what's called the hyperspace. And we've denoted it by CS. So it's a collection of all of these regions with a certain topology. I don't want to write down now, which is not too hard. Okay. So now let me write down the final conjecture. Okay, I need to reformulate this a little because I'm jumping ahead in my notes. So, or let me write it down as it is, and then. So the Euclidean QFTs on some bundle P from E to S are n bijection with the internal continuous probability valuations on the associated internal topological space. So now this is when you take define your topos in terms of this hyperspace. Here what I mean by Euclidean QFT is basically a measure, a probability measure, or a continuous probability evaluation really on the space of sections of some map like this. Then the conjecture says that if you take this sort of thing, this is a family of spaces, really, if you look, take the fibers of this P, it's a family of spaces indexed by the point here. And now if you define, consider continuous probability evaluations on this topological space, it seems to correspond to, or at least be very close to, then these probability measures on the sections, which are the Euclidean QFTs. Okay, yeah, I think I should be finishing, thanks.
So I have two questions. One is just a tiny technical question, and the other is maybe a broader.
Mm-hmm.
First one is the topology you alluded to on C of X, some sort of intuitionist version of the Torus topology.
No, it's even not intuitionistic. I mean, this is external now. This is the base space in which we consider sheaves. And I forgot which one is the Vitoris topology, but it may just be that one. So the basic open sets are given by you take an open in S and then just consider the set of all compacts that are contained in that open U.
Is that all you use? Just those?
Just these.
So that's weaker than the Vitoris.
Okay. Yeah. So this is very non-separate. I mean, has bad separation.
That was the little one. So the other question is, if you go back to your example where you, a very simple example of the failure of the law of excluded middle, where you took an open interval, and you formed its intuitionist complement, and you observed, of course, you lose the two endpoints.
Uh-huh.
So the two endpoints, of course, are a very, very tiny part of the line.
Yeah.
Negligible in every sense of the word. And, of course, in measure theory and actually even in topology, we learn all kinds of ways of modding out by negligible sets.
Yeah.
Is there some technique you can use to mod out the, in some sense, negligible things so as to get back Boolean algebra?
Yes, there is. And
this is also in some ways an important part of the theory, but which I don't personally know so well. This is basically a double negation translation, if you've heard that before. So what you can prove is that, so although the law of excluded middle fails, what you can prove is that its double negation is always true. And this is basically saying that this set is always dense. and yeah, if you look at all the sets that are double negations, these form a Boolean algebra. And that, yeah, so this is how Boolean things embed into here.
So you're not modded out by the negligible.
No, but I think you can do that. And then you get something which is called, you get a frame. And I think this is called the smallest dense sublocale, if you've heard this thing before. Yeah, but this is really, to my mind, this is kind of mind-blowing, that if you take this, in this point-free topology, every space has a smallest dense subspace. And this is what you get when you mod out by things that have equal closures.
I'm sorry if you already mentioned this, but this is semantics of open sets. Is that sound incomplete for the intuitionistic logic?
That's an excellent question. And this is actually still a question that I have myself. I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't thought about this version. My own question was about if you take also the quantifiers into account, is it then sound incomplete for these sheaf topuses? And I've asked some kind of toposters, but they didn't know. And one gets into subtleties about distinction between Grothendieck topos and elementary topos, so I think it's a very subtle issue.
Two questions, one short one, one longer one. So you talked about the dimensions of the theories, like C equals one corresponding to stochastic processes.
Yeah.
Is that a metaphor or is there really some dimension?
No, this is supposed to be space-time dimension or space dimension.
Why?
So stochastic process is a bunch of random variables indexed by time. Right? So time is usually, by the mathematicians who study stochastic processes, taken to be one-dimensional, taken to be R.
So for QFT, why can't I have dimension one?
Oh, you can. Yeah, sure. I'm sorry. You can. I mean, this is. I was just trying to say that maybe the more interesting ones are in dimension two and higher.
So this.
But yeah, certainly. I mean, I would even consider d equals zero a valid dimension, which you can consider. But yeah, D0 is kind of degenerate, and dimension 1 is maybe still somehow special and easier.
Or maybe even fractal dimension.
I don't know about that.
But second question.
Yeah, okay. So one nice thing about this formalism is that I'm not assuming that space-time is a manifold. This works much more generally.
Second question is, why do you consider Euclidean QFT rather than Lorentzian?
Yeah, because I don't know how to treat The pragmatic answer is that because this was not originally intended to be about physics, but just about stochastic processes. And the more conceptual answer is that I don't know how to do it. I mean, I could try to set up this in terms of C-star algebras. but then in order to try and get something like AQFT, which is I was going to talk about, is kind of similar in some respects. But then the problem is that instead of having restriction maps how am I going to say this? Yeah, it just turns out to be kind of go the wrong way. Instead of having inclusions of observable algebras as you make your region of spacetime bigger, it would be a projection. The short answer is I don't know how to do it.
I couldn't tell whether the logic supports material implication, and if it does, how do you get around some of those well-known paradoxes like the Lewis ones? That's the first question. The second one, this notion of implication, like often implication has some intuitive connection with causality. So do you see the, any prospects of the implication defined in this to sort of mount some meaningful sort of, or maybe alternative view of causality that's built into the underlying?
Yeah. So I don't see any connection with causality, to be honest.
Yeah.
And material implication, I've seen the term, but yeah, I don't actually know what it means. Is it easy to explain in one sentence?
So, material implication is defined as P implies Q is not P or Q.
Ah, okay. No, so this does not work.
Yeah.
Yeah. As one can also see, well, in the example that I had written down here, I think then this will be different. And this one is just the better behaved one, in a sense that what is still correct here, and that one can also more or less read off here, is that V and U implies V, if and only if, no, I think I've done this. If and only if V, something like this. I'm not sure I can write it down now, but this is correct. So this is kind of an alternative characterization of, okay, let me put it like this. So this is still a nice property one wants to have and a material implication would not have.
Specifically the last part, is it any easier to consider
there
a discrete case? Like, are you in?
Yes, so we've proven, yes, actually that's, we've proven the case where both S and the bundle are discrete and finite. It sounds like a very special case, but it's actually still quite tricky. So that's sort of how we're actually going about it. Yeah.
Final question.
Is it, so it's just a general question. Is it the case that if you exclude the law of excluded middle from a logic, then the only kinds of proofs you can have are constructive proofs?
Well, it depends on what other rules you still have.
Right. So you need to impose something additional, but proofs by contradiction would not work.
Exactly, yeah. That's roughly how it works. And the ones that are valid are precisely the constructive ones. I mean, the inference rules that one uses are those of constructive mathematics.
Let's thank you, Tobias, again.